The scripture reading this morning is from 2 Corinthians, the 4th chapter, verses 16 through 18. I'm reading from the New American Standard Version. And we will find as we read this, it is a comfort to the Corinthian brethren as well as a comfort to us. It says, "Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. For we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal."
I want to start by considering the lyrics to song number 227 in Hymns for Worship. We know it as "There is a Habitation." It reads, "There is a habitation built by the living God for all of every nation who seek that grand abode. A city with foundations firm as the eternal throne. No wars nor desolations shall ever move a stone. No night is there, no sorrow, no death, no decay, no yesterday, no morrow, but one eternal day. Within its pearly portals, angelic armies sing with glorified immortals the praises of its King. O Zion, lovely Zion, I long thy gates to see. O Zion, lovely Zion, when shall I dwell in thee?" What's interesting about that song, as well as several of the other songs that Brian led this morning in preparation for today's lesson, is a lot of the lyrics to these songs are as much about what won't be in heaven as what will be there. You ever notice that? It talks about how there's no death, that there is no decay. There's no wars. There'll be no evil, no sin. And those are all wonderful things. And so I want to talk about this morning of not only what is going to be in heaven, which is obviously God and His glory and a relationship with Jesus Christ, but what will not be in heaven as well. This is a beautiful earth at times. I had one of those moments the other day that was just, it was a perfect moment. As perfect as life on earth can be, that is. When the temperature is perfect, and there's sun peeking between the leaves on the trees, and your little girl is there blowing bubbles in the breeze. You ever have those perfect moments? Those perfect moments where you just, where a picture just doesn't capture what it's like? It's that moment when the team wins. It's that moment when you're surrounded by family. It's that moment when the temperature's just right, the beautiful spring day. It's that moment when you see that loved one that you have not seen for a couple years. It's that moment when a stressful situation is finally relieved and you can breathe that sigh of relief. At times, this life can be really, really sweet. And I'll never deny that God created a beautiful earth. But because of the corruption due to sin, this is also a rather horrible place to be for a time. This is a place that is filled with incredible heartache. It is filled with natural disasters and loss and pain, both in the body as well as in the soul. It's a place where we lose our homes, where we lose our possessions, where we are displaced because of natural disaster or because of war or because of persecution. It's a place where not every child this night is going to have a warm, safe place to rest his or her head. It is a world where a wonderful place like St. Jude Hospital has to exist. And I got to go on a tour earlier last week with Walt It's a very amazing facility. He's doing great work there, the other staff members there. There's a lot of great work going on there. And St. Jude, in a world that is broken, is one thing that's working. Like, that's one thing on planet Earth. At least St. Jude is working pretty well. But it's sad that St. Jude has to exist at all. It's sad that St. Jude has to exist at all. This is a world where people are oppressed by other human beings simply because one group wants to control the way the other one speaks and thinks and behaves. This is not a very pleasant planet. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again. The vast majority of humanity, for the vast majority of human history, has lived under very terrible conditions. The vast majority of humanity, for the vast majority of human history, has faced daily struggle where they don't know where food is going to come from that day, where life expectancy is not nearly what it is today. That is the great bulk of humanity has lived under horrible conditions. But for now, this earthly abode is all we have. This is all we have. This is the best that we have available to us. You want to try living on the moon? Go ahead. It's not as nice as here. You want to be the first person to go to Mars? That's fine, I suppose. But it's definitely not as nice as here. I mean, even like Nevada is nicer than Mars. Because at least Nevada has an atmosphere. Any native Nevadans here? I don't know if we have any native Nevadans here. I've been to Reno before. Reno's a nice little town, though. I like Reno. Reno's a nice, pretty town. But for now, this is all we have available to us. There are no other options. Like, there's nowhere we can go. There's no plan B. Like, there's no, like, other planet that we've been saving for a while, like, saving it for a rainy day when we ruin this one another. There's nowhere else we can go. This is it. Planet Earth is all we have until we die and leave and face God in judgment. And so Paul makes an interesting observation in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 about this very thing. Go to 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and notice the way he puts it here. Now for context's sake, I want to start back in chapter 4 verse 16, but let's go straight into chapter 5, which is really where I want to make my point out of this particular text. So in 2 Corinthians 4:16, going right on into chapter 5, the text says this: "Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal." So he goes on in chapter 5, verse 1 and says, "For we know that if the earthly tent, which is our house, is torn down, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For indeed in this house we groan, longing to be clothed with our dwelling from heaven, inasmuch as we, having put it on, shall not be found naked." Now we'll stop there for just a sec. What he's saying is, physical life on planet Earth is like living in a tent. It's a temporary shelter, a temporary existence. And for now, it's the best thing that you have available to you. And if you're out camping, and your choices are, uh-oh, there was a rainstorm coming that I didn't anticipate, I can get in the tent, and it'll do a pretty good job as long as the rainfly is on. Or I could just stand out in the rain and get wet all night. Which one would you rather have? Well, you'd rather have the tent. But what if someone came up and said, you know, you don't have to live in a tent. There's a house just like a quarter mile that way. Which one would you rather have then? Well, you want the house, of course. But what Paul is saying is, as long as we're here, it's like living in a tent. It's a temporary shelter. It's limited. It only does so much good. But while we're here, it's the best thing that we have. And you wouldn't want to be caught out in the elements naked. You wouldn't want to be caught out in the elements without the tent. You'd rather have the tent than nothing. But he goes on to say in verse 4, "For indeed, while we are in this tent, we groan, being burdened." because we don't want to be unclothed, but to be clothed, in order that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. And like I said, if this is all we have, I mean, I'd rather have this than nothing. I'd rather have planet Earth with all of its limitations than non-existence. I'm grateful that I exist. For as much heartache as there is on planet Earth, I appreciate that God had enough grace to even let me exist at all and to not just simply prevent me from existing in the first place. But I groan. And I know you groan too. Because I know you've had a family member die of something, like cancer. I know you groan because you've felt aches and pains in your body, just like I have. I know you groan because you've struggled with money at times. I know you groan because relationships aren't always peachy, because people fight with each other and are stubborn with each other, betray each other, lie to each other, commit adultery against each other. I know you groan because you've seen the news. You know that it is no worse today than it's ever been. Let's not get dramatic about it, right? The world's not falling apart around us. It's basically what it's always been. Jesus himself said in Matthew chapter 24, when you hear of wars and rumors of wars and famines and earthquakes, don't fret. That's just planet Earth operating normally. But I know you groan, because you're as affected by the limitations and pains of this life as I am. I groan. I know you groan. In this life we groan, being burdened, he says. But what we really want is the mortal to be swallowed up by immortality. Verse 5, now he who prepared us for this very purpose is God, who gave us the Spirit as a pledge. Therefore, being always of good courage, and knowing that while we're at home in the body, we're absent from the Lord, for we walk by faith and not by sight, he says in verse 7. We are of good courage, I say, and prefer rather to be absent from the body and to be at home with the Lord. Therefore, verse 9 says, we have as our ambition, whether at home or absent, to be pleasing to him. What do you really want? Do you want just like a nicer version of planet Earth, or do you want heaven? There are many things here that are not going to exist in heaven, and I appreciate that. Now, let's understand something, that the connection between sin and suffering is a general one. It's not specific to any one person's sins. And we always have to be really careful about that. We have to make sure that we're understanding this subject properly, because when we talk about sin and death and sin and decay and the connection between all those things, we might tend to blame ourselves then. Like, well, I lost my job because I committed a sin and God is punishing me. Or why did God make that family member sick? Well, it must be because I committed some sin. Well, that's not always the case. In fact, in John chapter 9, when the disciples asked Jesus about the man born blind, they said, well, who committed sin? Was it his parents? And so they're the ones being punished by having a blind son? Or was it him? Did he commit the sin? And that's why he was born blind. And Jesus' response is, it had nothing to do with sin. At least as far as like that specific person's sin. You know, the reason why suffering exists on planet Earth is not because you personally sinned and made it so that all this suffering is upon your family. It's because there's a general connection between sin and suffering. And as long as sin exists on planet Earth, suffering will also exist on planet Earth. It is a general connection between those two things, not a specific connection between one person's sin. You don't get the flu just because you committed a sin. Right, you getting the flu and you committing a sin are not a specific connection. But pain and suffering exist because sin in general also exists. Disease and heartache and disaster, those things strike indiscriminately. Luke chapter 13, verses 1 through 5. In fact, let's read that passage, because what Jesus says here is very illuminating on this subject. In Luke chapter 13, verse 1, now on the same occasion there were some present who reported to him about the Galileans, whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. And he answered and said to them, do you suppose that these Galileans were greater sinners than all other Galileans because they suffered this fate? Was this fate directly connected to their specific sins? I tell you no, verse 3, but unless you repent, you'll all likewise perish. Or do you suppose that those 18 on whom the tower in Siloam fell and killed them were worse culprits than all the men who live in Jerusalem? I tell you no, but unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. You know, buildings fall over. Car accidents happen. Governments rise and fall, and revolutions follow along with them. People are oppressed. Earthquakes happen. Rain falls, and Jesus says in Matthew 5, the rain falls on the good as well as the evil. Now, what's interesting about that is that's a two-edged sword. We might view that as a blessing, that the rain falls as a blessing on both the evil and the good. But guess what? The rain also falls as a curse on the evil and the good. We all like rain as long as we don't have too much of it. The rain falls indiscriminately. Hurricanes don't pick and choose whose houses they're going to destroy. My aunt and uncle, who are Christians, they live down in Orange, Texas, or near Beaumont, Texas, southeast Texas. Their home has been destroyed twice in less than 2 years because of hurricanes. Twice. And the ironic thing behind that is both times it happened. Very, very soon, or at least that first time it happened very, very soon after my uncle was baptized. So is that God's reward then for someone becoming a Christian? That his house would be flooded with 6 feet of water because of a hurricane? Like, is that a direct connection being made there? Be careful not to blame God, because the chaos and carnage is a result of our collective sin. And as long as sin exists, disorder and everything else will follow with it. James 3, verse 16 makes that connection, that where selfishness and envy and jealousy exist, every other evil thing along with disorder will follow right after it. Romans chapter 5 and verse 12 and onward through the end of the chapter. The reason why we die? Well, partly because Adam sinned and Adam died. But really, we die because we've all, in the same manner as Adam, committed sin. And so because all of us have sinned, then all of us are impacted by death as well. There's a general connection between sin and death. In some ways, our heavenly abode, our heavenly home, will be defined by the things that won't be there as much as the things that will be there. And of course, being in the presence of God is the central feature of our heavenly existence. But the Bible writers, as well as the writers of numerous hymns that we sing on a regular basis, don't shy away from describing the absence of things like pain and suffering as being a key component of that eternal life. Let me give you a few examples. Go to Romans chapter 8 and verse 18. In Romans chapter 8, and it says in verse 18 and onward, "For I consider that the sufferings of this life are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us." Now, if the sufferings of this life cannot compare to the glory that will be revealed to us, what is being implied there? That the suffering and the glory aren't going to coexist with each other. That the suffering one day will cease. We will replace suffering with glory in the afterlife. I think you get a little bit of that from 1 Corinthians 15 as well. Remember in 1 Corinthians 15, about halfway through the chapter, the Apostle Paul talks about how there's a glory of this kind of body and a glory of that kind of body. There's a glory of the heavenly bodies like the sun, the moon, the stars. There's a glory that comes along with our earthly body. It's impressive. I mean, mine's not very impressive, but maybe yours is. That was a joke. Wow. Boy, I didn't realize you all agreed with me that much. All right, he's right about that. But there is a certain kind of glory to the human existence. I mean, this is an amazing creation, an amazing design. On a molecular level, this is an amazing thing that God has made. But the glory of this life is going to be replaced by a glory that is inexpressible. And so in our heavenly abode, all of the suffering of this life will be replaced by glory. Going back to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 50 and onward. O death, where's your sting? O death, where's your victory? It's gone. Replaced by victory in Jesus Christ. There will be no death there. There will be no death in heaven. I don't even think we can comprehend that. Because we're so surrounded by death. I mean, everything is framed in terms of death. Maybe you don't think of it that way or say it that way, but I mean, the amount of time you have left on earth, the amount of time you have left with a loved one, a family member, a best friend, the amount of things and activities and accomplishments that you want to have before you die, you got to fit it all in. You've got to see it all. You're telling me you're going to go to your grave without seeing the Grand Canyon? I don't think so. You got to fit that one in there. And you got to drive down Route 66 at some point. Why? Because you just have to, I guess. Get yourself like a refrigerator magnet to remember how fun it was to drive 500 miles on a boring, ugly highway. But you got to fit it in there because someday you're going to die and you'll regret that you didn't do it. Everything's framed in terms of like the limited amount of time that we have left on earth. Death is all around us. Every single day people die. And if you don't realize that, just drive down the freeway sometime. And the Department of Transportation puts on those boards all the time the number of people who died in Tennessee this year because of highway accidents. There's reminders all around us. I just think it's very hard for us to comprehend what a life with no death is going to be like. An existence that is ceaseless, that is eternal, that's never framed in terms of limitation or ending or cessation or from point A to point B, because point B never exists. And if you understand that better than I do, then maybe you can teach me a thing or two about it. But the book of Revelation in chapter 21, verse 4 says, there will be no crying, there will be no pain, there will be no mourning in that place. For all the first things have passed away. New things have come in their place. Go to Revelation chapter 21 and the end of the chapter now, verse 22. I already mentioned the song, There Is a Habitation. One thing they mention there in that book is about light. And there's no sun there, no sun, no moon, no stars, no physical light there. Why is that? Why is there going to be no physical light in heaven? Well, it says in verse 22, and I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple. And the city has no need of the sun or of the moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb. Verse 25. And in the daytime, for there shall be no night there, its gates shall never be closed. No temple, which means that we have direct access to God. No sun, which means that everything we need to survive comes directly from God. Now that's true today, but there's this kind of layer of physical things, this layer of material that shrouds our thinking when it comes to who provides what for us. And no night. There's no night there. No darkness, no ending. Go back to Revelation chapter 21. No wickedness. I think of all the things that won't be there, this is the one that kind of affects me the most. Look at Revelation 21, verse 27 now. Nothing unclean and no one who practices abomination and lying shall ever come into it, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's book of life. And what I want to notice about that is this. I think the source of our greatest pain on earth isn't always physical. It's not always about aches and pains or a body being broken or an accident that happens or money problems. That's not always the source of our greatest pain. Other people's sin, the way it impacts us, the way it hurts us. You know, in heaven, you're never going to have to be on your guard against scams, liars, charlatans, and false preachers. In heaven, you are never going to have to be on your guard against somebody trying to take advantage of you, because the scammers can't get in. The scammers can't get into heaven. The people trying to take from you, the people trying to abuse you, they can't get in. That doctor that took advantage of you, that coach that molested you, that boss that didn't treat you right, they won't be there. They won't be there. And I get to spend the rest of eternity letting my guard down. I'm really looking forward to that. There's a lot of enemies out there. A lot of bad people out there on planet Earth. And I'll tell you what, I've been one of them sometimes. At times, I'm not always the nicest person or the kindest person or the most compassionate person. I've been bad sometimes. But we get to go to heaven, and for the first time ever, we get to completely let our guard down. For the rest of eternity, I never have to worry about the lust of the eyes. I never have to worry about the way that pornography might impact me or the way that greed might impact me. I never have to wake up in the morning, because there's no night there, remember, but I never have to wake up in the morning in heaven and go, "Phew, boy, there's a lot on my plate today. There's a lot of concerns on my plate today, a lot of worries on my plate today, a lot of temptations that I'm going to have to face today. I got to be on my guard today. I got to spend time with that person today that always brings out the worst in me, that always tempts me to be the worst person, the worst version of me." There's no wickedness there. No wickedness there. And there's no curse either. Chapter 22, verse 3 of Revelation. No curse. And everything that comes along with that, all of the attending misery and woe of that curse will not be there. So what will be there? Because we talked a lot about what won't be there. I mean, I can go to a home. Like, I just bought a house 10 months ago. Remember? I just moved here. It feels like an eternity at this point, doesn't it? You've had to listen to me for 10 months. And you're like, wow, it really feels more like 10 years at this point. But you know, you don't go into a house and just look around and go, well, it's nice there's not a dead body on the living room floor. I mean, that's an upside. Oh, that's a plus. Right? Like, you don't go through a house and just think about what's not there. And we'd be remiss if we just did a sermon on, well, in heaven there's going to be none of this and none of that and none of this thing and none of that thing, which is all very important and all very true, but I want to know what will be there. What do I have to look forward to in heaven? What's drawing me there and driving me there? I love Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12 is such a great passage because it describes the Mount of Zion, not Mount Sinai, which is a mountain to be feared, but Mount Zion. A mountain that draws you in. It says here in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 22. Look at this here. He says, "But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem." And by the way, that to me is the connection there to Revelation 21, right? Because he talks about there being a new Jerusalem, right? The city there that comes down from heaven. Right? That's what he's talking about there, the new Jerusalem. "And to myriads of angels, to the general assembly and the church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of righteous men made perfect." Well, that's really cool. Think about what you get in heaven. Relationships. I know that... we think of heaven as being streets of gold and I get a mansion. This is just my personal preference. I get that a lot of songs we sing like mansion over the hilltop and that sort of thing, or I want a mansion. I get that there's some poetic license there and there's some symbolism that's being used. But to me, the real draw for heaven is not mansions and gold streets. It's silly to think of heaven in just those kinds of carnal terms. It's silly. I don't care about that. And that's not what's going to be there. You don't get to heaven and they go, it's like, "Lifestyles of the rich and famous in heaven. Welcome now." You don't get to heaven and they hand you the keys to a big golden mansion. That's not literally what's going to happen. You know what you're going to find in heaven? When he talks about, I prepare a dwelling place for you, what Jesus means is, I'm preparing home for you. I'm not making a house, I'm making home for you. Where it is relationship, where it is welcome, where it is safety. You are secure in a dwelling place with God and His people for all eternity. That's what's being promised in heaven. And so he says, when you come to the New Jerusalem, look what you have. You have myriads of angels. And you know what? If those angels, like Luke chapter 15 says, if those angels were singing when you first became a Christian, when a sinner turned from his evil way, how much do you think those angels are going to be singing when you finally get to heaven and meet them? Those angels were singing the day you were baptized. And they're waiting to sing the song to welcome you into the heavenly abode as well. But you don't just get to meet myriads of angels, but the General Assembly and the Church of the Firstborn. Every saint ever is going to be there. Every single saint ever is going to be there. The spirits of righteous men made perfect. We talk sometimes about who we'd like to meet. If I could go back in time and meet one person from the Bible, who would it be? There's some really interesting cats from the Bible. You get to meet every single one of them, at least those who are right in the eyes of God. Every single interesting saint from the Bible, you don't get to just like meet Elijah and go, if I could just get your autograph, Elijah, I'd be out of your hair. I want to pester you or anything. Paul the Apostle, we really enjoyed those. What about Romans 9, though? That was really hard. You get to share an eternal relationship with them as well. And to Jesus in verse 24, the greatest hero of all time. The greatest hero of all time. You get to come to Jesus. And you get to dwell in His house. You get to dwell in His house. Oh, Zion, lovely Zion. When shall I dwell in thee? We want to become Christians because we want to avoid hell. And I don't think there's anything illogical or unreasonable about that being at least an initial motivation to becoming a Christian. If you don't want to go to hell, become a Christian. Because becoming a Christian is the best way to not end up going to hell. But at some point in our spiritual journey, we have to mature beyond that initial motivation. We have to move beyond, I became a Christian because I was afraid of hell, to, I am now serving the rest of my life as a Christian because I want to go to heaven. Not wanting to go to hell is fine. That's a great, valid, logical motivation to become a Christian. But that can't be the only thing that is driving us. So do you want to go to heaven? Does it sound good enough for you? Good enough to forsake the things of this world? To sacrifice your life for Christ's sake? To consider yourself as last so that He might make you first? To serve Him with everything? And, if necessary, to die for His name's sake? Is that worth it to you? I certainly hope that it is. And so does Jesus. If you have any spiritual need at all, then I encourage you to please let that spiritual need be known right now by coming forward as we stand and sing.